ROTC.
I'm going to show my ignorance here, but I mean, what kind of ROTC training goes on in school districts, and is that an accredited course, and why would, I mean, I understand the argument with regard to native language and culture, but I don't understand it with regard to military science.
Okay, well, whoever you'd like to come up to the table on that one.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll have Mr. Wagner come in.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Tom Wagner with the Department of Law. To answer Representative Ulmer's question, my understanding is that the Anchorage School District currently has an ROTC program and that they are considering putting ROTC programs into Bethel and Kotzebue. I believe those are probably the only programs in the state. It turns out that in Anchorage, some of the instructors are people who hold baccalaureate degrees, but others are not. Others are people who, they're enlisted men who may have a expertise in marching or sharpshooting or whatever it is, whatever aspect of military science it is that they teach in their course, but do not have the academic training of a baccalaureate degree. So they're included in this bill to allow them to function as teachers in the public school system as well.
Last time we looked into this in the 13th legislature, they were doing that on active duty. They were attacked through the school. They were under Valerie at the time. Is that still the same situation?
I don't know, Representative. I know that part of the problem concerning those people with teacher certification is that I believe currently the Anchorage School District is saying that these people are not required to hold a teaching certificate. They are instructors, not teachers. And teachers' retirement system won't allow them in unless a teacher certificate is a requirement to do the job.
Right.
So this bill, the way it defines teacher, would definitely make it a requirement of the job. And then there would be this exemption or exception for people who didn't have baccalaureate degrees to teach in that area.
Mr. Chairman, I think it ought to be taken out. I mean, if these are basically people that are working for the military and in a retirement system with the military, why we would want to include them in the teacher's retirement system, I guess, is beyond me. I'm sorry if I'm missing something obvious here, but am I?
Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most of those people have already gotten out of the military service. And this is their job since they've retired.
The other thing on that is that one of the sections that's not being amended by this bill is AS 1420.010, which says in order to be employed as a teacher in the public schools, you must hold a teacher certificate. Some of these military science people who do not have a baccalaureate degree would not qualify for a teacher certificate unless there's an exception made for them or unless they get an emergency certificate. So part of the problem is just having them legally in the classroom no matter what retirement system they might be in.
Further discussion?
I guess I also have a question about vocational or technical course. Again, if I understand the sponsor's intent, I do understand native language or culture, but the rest of this, I guess I'm not clear on why we are creating a special category of instructors. If they're already teaching, and that's not a problem.
They have expert certification.
Then the only reason we're doing this is to allow them to get retirement?
The only reason is to establish and standardize the categories that are already in existence within the state of Alaska, to standardize and do away with the inconsistencies within the statutes that we now have.
It introduces an inconsistency.
See, to me, this doesn't necessarily do away with the inconsistencies, and I guess if I speak on a personal basis, I do not have a teaching certificate. And in order for me to go back to teach whatever course, I would have to be recertified.
Or else you could get an expert.
And Representative McLean?
Mr. Chairman, the other thing that I wanted to express is that there are some vocational and technical courses that are being taught by people without degrees, except that they're experts in the field of welding and those type of courses that you don't really need a baccalaureate degree for. But what this does is give a limited certificate valid in the expertise that they can teach in, and it also strengthens that in order for them to continue, if they're going to continue to, by regulation, establish courses which leads to baccalaureate degree.
Further discussion? Representative Brown?
I'm not finding the fiscal note, and I guess I wonder, I think the sponsor stated that there was a zero fiscal note here.
There is a zero fiscal note.
It's zero for the state, but not for the local district.
So, okay.
No argument there.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? What action does the committee wish in this bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Swackhammer?
Yes. I'd move House Bill 203 from committee with this one.
Are there any objections? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you. House Bill 301. As an act revising existing laws describing the powers and duties of state agencies in order to realize reductions in the state budget provided for an effective date. That raises many levels of concern, I'm sure, but it's also something that we're going to have to continue to look at as an ongoing basis, so I did want to bring it up. My recommendations would be, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the subcommittee. However, if someone wants to take more action on that. Immediate Representative Brown?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've looked at this bill briefly, and of course it does cover a wide variety of activities of state government, from education to RATNET to the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Lands, the Minerals Commission, just a lot of different areas. In thinking about what work the Fiscal Policy Subcommittee would like to do over the interim, we would like to continue to look at areas of state government where we need or where we could do things in a more efficient way. And so I guess we're planning to look at a lot of these areas, and if you're going to set up a separate subcommittee for this, I'd like to be on it.
Well, basically what we were planning with Chairman Hoffman and myself and the Fiscal Policy Committee.
Okay, when you named them off, who would be on it? You didn't mention me, so I'd like to be added.
Oh, I'm sorry. Here's the that I moved up. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chairman, whether I'm on this or not, I'd like to know when you're having meetings, because I do have some concerns about it in some of the areas.
Well, it's an area that I haven't really been able to look at too much on the bill, but I just didn't want it to die, because I think there are things we have to look at. Did we have anything else to on our calendar today? And remember, we'll meet again tomorrow morning at 8:30. And once again, at 8:30, we'll be looking at House Bill 85, the program receipts bill. Any new or update on House Bill 154? We wouldn't plan on moving that at least until Tuesday.
Then SJR 18, SJR 30 amended, SB 128, SB 129, and SB 169 are all on our schedule for tomorrow. Also, conference committee is scheduled to begin at 3:30 tomorrow afternoon with just kind of a general session so that as quickly as possible, then we'll be able to sit down with the various subcommittee chairmen and outline procedures that we will need to have the information that's necessary to help us at the conference committee. So, if nothing else, the meeting's adjourned.
Well, I hear just the time.
Therefore, we're able to conduct business. And I think we have some bills that we can run through relatively quickly here, others that may take a little more time. But between now and our meeting at 1:30 this afternoon, we hope to be able to get through our schedule today. And also noted on our schedule today should be House Bill 208. As you recall, last Friday or Saturday, we received permission to waive the five-day rule so that that bill could be heard today. So we would add that to our agenda. So if we could probably start with SCR 18, and then we do SCR 30, and then I'd like to move to Senate Bill 129, which would be third. And I'd like to recognize Senator Sturgiluski, too, if she has a bill that she would like brought
Senate
up.
Senate Bill 128, revision extension.
Okay. That one's going to be a hard one. It might take 2 minutes.
Okay. A minute and a half. Okay.
Okay. Why don't we just make that number three then? Okay, the first one is SCR 18. It's by Senator Binkley requesting the governor to direct the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education to work with the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse to act as a clearinghouse for inhalant abuse information. SCR 18 requests the governor to direct HESS to include information on inhalant abuse in its drug and alcohol abuse advertising. SCR 18 resolves that information regarding non-toxic office products should be provided to the state purchasing agent for every state agency, including the legislature and the court system, and that these agencies should, whenever possible, purchase the non-toxic brand rather than those contain toxic substances. Do we have anyone who wants to be heard on SCR 18 at this time? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Janice Adair. I worked for Senator Binkley. The resolution is fairly self-explanatory, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Does anyone have any questions in regards to SCR 18? What action then does the committee wish? Representative Palmer.
I would move that we move the resolution from committee with individual recommendations and ask unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, paramilitary rights again. Tell the senator, you'll know what I mean. SJR 30 amended. It's by Senator Kertulin Szymanski and requests the U.S. Secretary of Labor to locate a job corps center within the Mat-Su borough. SJR 38 amended says that the state has no existing job corps centers and that locating one in Alaska will make it easier for Alaskans to stick with the program since they will be closer to their homes and families. The Mat-Su borough has existing facilities and the highest unemployment rate in the state, and there are 2-0 fiscal notes in your file, and Paula is here today to answer anyone's questions, so maybe we could have a brief presentation from Paula.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Terrell, and I'm to Senator Kutula. Before I say anything, I need to clarify. You have SJR 30 amended, and I'm talking with Carol. I understand that that's the way it is on basis, but there, it is just SJR 30. Shouldn't have an amended version. That was a mistake on basis.
Okay.
So it's still SJR 30. It threw me for a minute because I had no idea what the amended was. This resolution, which is before you, is basically it's requesting that the Secretary of Labor consider locating a job corps center in the Mat-Su borough. The Job Corps is a federally funded program under JTPA, the Job Training Partnership Act. It is amended. Excuse me.
You're into the amendment.
Yeah, and I'm afraid that I don't know what the amendment is here. Sorry.
Okay, Representative Brown.
Looks like lines 21 and 22 is where the amendment occurs. The original said, whereas Mansfield Borough has the highest unemployment in the state, the amended version says it has one of the highest, and it also looked like there's more honorable people listed on the amended version.
No major substitute.
No, there isn't anything major. I'm sorry, but I just didn't realize it. What has happened is that Congress appropriated additional funds for the establishment of new Job Corps training sites, and the state of Alaska has applied for to be selected as one of those sites. At this time, Alaska has no job training centers in Alaska, and all of our students go outside, and it's approximately 200 to 250, I'm not sure exactly the number, but they have to go outside right now for the program. So the purpose of this resolution is to ask that our application be accepted and that a site be established in the MATSU. The most recent update on this is that the federal government will be making their decision on May 12th. I think it's the first time we've actually had a date certain. And there is no fiscal note on the resolution. Karen Riles from the Department of Education is here if the members of the committee have any any questions, specific questions relating to this. And that's basically all I
have. Does anyone have any questions of Paula? What action does the committee wish in relation to SGR 30 amendment?
I move that we move SJR 30 from as a committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Representative Schultz.
Just a question. On the how was the this place selected? Through what process did it go through?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schultz, this question came up also in Senate Finance. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs was basically the lead agency for this, and they contacted several different communities in the state to see if they had facilities or if they were interested. One of them I know was the Kenai. One of the stipulations through the Secretary of Labor was that they wanted a site that was close to Anchorage. That was one of the
criteria.
Their priorities. Their criteria, basically. And then from there, the department did consult with other communities through the state.
You do that all the time.
Election personality.
I guess the reason I ask the question is that there are facilities sitting in the Toke area at the old pump station, and which has got tens of thousands of square footage of housing, of maintenance shops, of, you know, the whole thing. It's the old tank farm. And, but it's been sitting there for, you know, 12, 15 years vacant. And we were kind of wondering what the federal government was going to do with it. And we thought that maybe that was a good place to put it, but was never contacted on it.
The Mattsu Borough has been quite aggressive on it in relation to the new junior high and high school complex, which are vacant and which would make an ideal center.
Well, ours was ideal, too.
I'm saying ideal in the fact that you got two big, expensive buildings sitting empty.
Brand new.
With very nice, all-weather, lighted track.
Big stay in shape.
It makes me sad every time I drive by there. When we used to run on the road. Another story. Anything else in relation to SJR 30 amendment? Are there any objections to moving it to the committee with individual recommendations? Hearing none, then so ordered. Thank you, Bob. Next, then, we have Senate Bill 128, an act extending the termination date of the Alaska Code Revision Commission and providing for an effective date. And we have the prime sponsor with us today, Senator Sturgalewski, and welcome to House Finance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is an extension. The reason I put in the legislation, I've been for the Code Revision Commission, is because I've been very concerned that we had what I see as a very important group of people working on revising the statutes, the kind of thing that we don't ever seem to really find the time to get around to major revisions. It's composed of people in the attorney, the executive branch. Peter Froelich, AG, is on it. Three public members, including Judge Stewart, legislators, and a designee of the Bar Association. But we have had no staff for them, and they've dwindled down, so they really didn't have anybody to answer the telephone to give information or really for them to produce anything. So what we have worked out with legislative legal is a part-time both administrative assistant and legal advice that can really help and I think increase the production of what I see as a very important board. Basically, this was backed up by the legislative audit that said either provide some stability in staffing or get rid of it. I think it would be a tragic mistake to get rid of the Code Revision Commission. So that's the reason that the extension is before you in this forum, and I would certainly respond to any questions.
Okay, does anyone have any questions of the Senator? Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one. You know, they've been working on the corporate code, and I think there's one other. Do you have in mind a certain area of law that the commission should get into?
I do have backup material we took that I can make available to you. And taking a look with the revisers, you know, there are the reviser does the minor kinds of things, but on the code, it constantly needs to be looked at. Right now, for example, the Aviation Code Title II needs extensive work. There's been discussion that there are parts of the banking and securities that need it. So they're just a whole series of things, and I have had an analysis of that and could provide you with the list, but it's every state in the union has one form or another where they're constantly working at revisions. If you'll recall, we did Title 29. Now, that happened to be because there was a legislator, myself, interested in doing that. That turned out to be almost a 5 or 6 year project. If you don't have someone interested in some of the more arcane parts of the statute, they're simply not going to be addressed. So, and it gets beyond the strictly the reviser. It needs some policy decisions in it. So I think that Aviation Title II is the next one that needs a major look at it.
Further questions?
I'm ready to move the bill.
Okay. Would you like to make the motion?
Sure. Move the report out SB 128 with the accompanying fiscal note.
Objection for purpose of this.
Okay. Representative Kokanen?
The report, the performance review, made some suggestions such as replacing members who don't attend. Have the suggestions been acted on, considered?
Mr. Chairman, that it's a little bit embarrassing because it's tended to be our legislative members that have not been as faithful. I believe part of that is that it's almost been moribund, thanks to John Abbott and some of the people who've really worked on it, but there's not been the kind of thing in scheduling of meetings, of getting of minutes, of having timely information. I think that's an issue that can be resolved. And the people that are our current members, I think, are going to do a fine job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Just for the record, too, I do want to note the fiscal note by Legislative Affairs Agency. The estimated cost is approximately $51,000. And please note, as passed by the Senate, this includes $17,600 of fiscal year 90 funding, which has already been requested in the Legislative Affairs Agency budget request. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are the objections maintained? Hearing none, then, SB 128 has passed in committee with individual recommendation. Thank you. Next, we come to SB 129. An act relating to mining and providing for an effective date is sponsored by the Rules Committee by request of the Governor. SB 129 makes changes in the law regarding state mining claims, leasehold locations, and mining leases. The main purpose of SB 129 is to resolve the longstanding 6I issue, which has cast a legal cloud over the state's mining laws and statehood. The bill would impose rent and royalty requirements on state mining claims, leasehold locations, and mining leases. So included in your file is a copy of the governor's original transmittal letter, the fiscal note by the Department of Natural Resources, and copy of the 6I compromise. I might also note that Chairman Hoffman has asked to pull this bill at least one day. In fact, he's working on it right now. That's why he is absent. And he will have it back, and we plan on moving it out of committee by no later than Wednesday. So with that brief introduction, then, do we have anyone in the audience who wishes to speak on this bill at this time? Sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Klavinovich. I represent the Alaska Miners Association, and I have served that group as the chairman of the 6I committee that has been involved in attempting to resolve this question, which you quite correctly pointed out goes back to the Statehood Act, but it really began or came to the public forefront about 5 years ago. This committee is aware that the Alaska Supreme Court has found that the state's location system for mining claims violates Section 6I of the Statehood Act, and the state must charge rent or royalty on those mining claims located upon those lands that were mineral in character at time of selection by the state. Now, the imposition of any rent or royalty provision on state mining claims can drastically alter the financial equation of existing mining operations and create a strong disincentive to future investment. With that in mind, this association has participated in the current bill, which you have before you, with two objectives in mind. The first was to satisfy the court order, and the second was to produce legislation that would not jeopardize either existing mining operations or future mining operations on state lands. We believe that that bill before you accomplishes those two objectives. The imposition of any rent or royalty system adds another burden to an industry which we believe is burdened sufficiently. For that reason, the Alaska Miners Association cannot philosophically embrace this legislation. And yet, in the interest of clearing the stage and moving ahead with responsible exploration for and development of mineral resources on state lands, we ask that this committee forward this bill to the House floor for their consideration without amendment. Thank you, sir.
Does anyone have any questions?
I have a comment.
Representative Kopanen?
Thank you, Mr. Govinovich. I believe you knew Jack Boswell. I worked for the FE company in those days on the dredges, and after that I worked at the university, an electrician ran for the Constitutional Convention. Jack Boswell introduced this into the state constitution. At that time, it was to the interest of the FE company to lease large acreages of placer ground. And that, I remember the discussion, that's exactly why it was put in. So I thank you for your recommendation and intend to vote positively on it, but it was interesting to have been there at that committee hearing Jack Boswell put this forward.
Yes, I thank you too, and I want to assure you that we have every intent to move this out in a timely manner.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else who wishes? Mr. Bill Luden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Bill Glute from the Alaska Environmental Lobby. Senate Bill 129 is not everything that everyone involved in the discussions on it might want, but it is something that everyone can live with. The bill does ensure that the state gets a fair return on public or on private use of public resources. It does not conclusively address the reclamation issue, but it does begin to do so. And it's with our understanding, as stated by Senator Fahrenkamp a week ago Saturday in Senate Finance Committee, that there is intent to work through the interim on a more comprehensive reclamation bill, that we give our wholehearted support to this compromise bill. We do believe that reclamation will help the mineral industry, that it will not only be an environmentally positive thing, but that it will help industry to gain the public acceptance that it needs to continue and to be a viable economic factor in Alaska. We'd like to thank everyone involved for a lot of hard work and coming to a good compromise. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. And we also have Mr. Jerry Gallagher here if anyone has any questions that they would like to ask. Is there anyone that has any questions at this time? Representative Brown.
Thank you. Under what circumstances can a mining lease be canceled?
Representative Brown, we've been wrestling with that ourselves. We believe that although it hasn't been tested in the courts, any violation of any stipulation or condition of that lease, we could take action to cancel the lease. If I may continue, in this case, SB 129 that you have in front of you specifically amends the abandonment section of the lease so that if you don't pay your rent or your royalty, your mining claim, your mining lease, whatever, is automatically abandoned.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the new language in Section 7 about reclamation, it says, upon a determination by the commissioner that a miner has failed to follow the reclamation plan, the commissioner shall require proof of financial responsibility. Why are we not canceling the lease or the claim upon failure to follow the plan?
The reclamation section, as you know, was added to the 6I discussion as part of the package. This section, I don't believe anyone would say it answers all the questions, it addresses all the issues, and it solves all the problems. It's a first step in a difficult journey. We're going to have to answer some of these by regulation, and the legislature, the Resources Committee in both the Senate and the House have committed to initiate discussions about this in the summer and to consider the whole reclamation package in the next session. It's quite possible that a complete reclamation act will be before the legislature next year, and we'll have to address some of those. That's simply something that the details have not been worked out in this very brief language.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems like that we're precluding cancellation or precluding the department from taking action, and I'm not sure that that's what we want to do here in the statute. I mean, if we were just leaving it silent, we would be on much stronger ground.
Well, I'm not sure it precludes the department, Representative Brown. The leases typically carry a stipulation, a generic stipulation, that you will comply with all your permits, et cetera, et cetera. That would wrap it back into the written lease, which would probably, I can't say for sure, we haven't tested it, but would probably allow us to go after the lease itself if there was a violation. The intent here is that if there is a violation, this brief statute also requires the department by reg to adopt enforcement mechanisms. We don't have that in regulation right now. That's going to spell out some of this, but also this language would require essentially a bond if you don't follow your reclamation plan. That is discretionary now, and we would take the discretion away. It's not perfect. No one admits this is perfect, but it's a step forward.
Would you object to deletion of the language beginning on line 8, page 6, on a determination that a miner has failed to follow?
I would have to object to any changes in this bill at this point.
Well, I guess my point is, Mr. Chairman, if you want to leave open the possibility of cancellation, this language should be eliminated because it seems like it precludes that. I had a couple of other questions.
Please proceed.
Why are we going for a net income, 3% of royalty on the net income as opposed to the gross, which is traditional for royalties to be gross, not net?
The issue of royalty, specifically net versus gross, was discussed substantively and for quite a lengthy period of time by both Resources Committee. As I said, this was a package that was evolved that everyone could live with, and the Resources Committees on both sides finally agreed on 3% of the net, recognizing that net can be difficult in some cases to administer. On the other hand, it has the least economic effect on the viability of an operation. That was the agreement that was reached by the committees.
And how much revenue is lost to the state by going for a net as opposed to a gross?
How much is lost?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't characterize it as lost. If the revenue, I'll make a quick calculation in my head, if the royalty was 1% of the gross from state land, that would be $200,000 approximately. I have to go back and do my arithmetic. If it was 3% of the net, it would be about approximately $50,000. Some numbers to compare. There's a difference between net and gross here. You're aware of this.
How does the department intend to implement the net provision?
The net is defined as tied specifically to the definition in the mining license tax, AS-43. The miners are already required to submit that calculation to the Department of Revenue. We intend to use that calculation as well. Our fiscal note is constructed. You don't see an extra body in there, but what's hidden in there is we believe with upgrading our computer capabilities, we have the ability to reclassify at least one and perhaps two existing positions in the royalty accounting text. We intend to take a fairly aggressive approach to accounting for the royalties, making sure everything's done properly. It really is our only job. We don't have a whole bunch of things on a list of priorities. Mining is our job. We intend to pursue it correctly and vigorously. And I guess if we don't, I expect this committee and anybody else to bust my butt.
Well, I just note, Mr. Chairman, that we've not pursued the mining collection of the mining tax at all and are virtually collecting nothing of what the state is owed under that. What authority does the department have to require information necessary to determine what is the percentage of the gross?
The specific authorities will be worked out in regulation. They will be a mirror image of the existing requirements under the mining license tax. And in Section 9 of this SB 129, there is an authorization that the Department of Revenue provide to DNR all data, information, worksheets, and whatever from the mining license tax that is not now available to us.
But isn't it true that only a fraction of the miners are even filing anything under the mining license tax?
I wish folks from Revenue were here, but there is a there's certainly not 100% filing. It's a little some of the data that's been put on the table. Is a little confusing. It's not, we don't have access to that ourselves. But I can tell you, mining is our only job. There's 200 operators on state land, and all 200 of those will file returns with the Division of Mining, or they'll lose their claim.
Do you believe the department needs clear authority to require the information?
No, I believe that there's adequate authority here.
And where would I find that authority? Where does it say that you have that authority?
It does not say so directly, but the Department of Law has advised that we have full authority to administer this.
I'll defer to Representative Rieger.
Representative Rieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of miscellaneous questions. It caught my eye on how labor is defined for keeping your claim. And I'm just curious on this. It talks about surveys of some sort or another. How do you keep your claim once you've begun production? Where is the provision that says that you aren't doing labor anymore, you're doing production?
Well, the existing law, and this labor is from the mining law of 1872, update a little bit. Even when you're in production, you have to continue to do annual labor and make that filing every year. What this amends is that doesn't this bill does not relieve the miner of that obligation to do the labor and to make the filing annually. What this does is add the rental, and in the case of once you go into production, you initiate the royalty payment.
Okay. If I can continue. On the payment, there is new language which talks about a deficiency notice. If someone fails, let's just say the person didn't file a proof of labor, does that mean that person gets a deficiency notice for $100 or whatever the dollar amount is?
No, a failure to file.
or a failure to file late is an automatic abandonment. That's the way the law has been since 1872. That's the way the law has been since 1959, and we're not proposing to make any changes in that.
Okay, so this is only if you filed, but you filed the wrong dollar.
Right. If you owe the department, the state, $100 and you pay $80 because of some confusion, then that would initiate a deficiency notice. Obviously, you had some good faith intent there, but for some reason failed to fully comply.
Okay. Well, that's all I have. I think that I would have probably preferred a percentage of gross rather than a percentage of net also. Even if it were the same amount of revenue, it would probably save a lot of administration costs.
Representative Kopanen?
How would a mining property be transferred to another party?
The same way it is now, through a quick claim deed, through some other conveyance document. It doesn't reset the clock in terms of escalating the rental. No changes in that provision.
Is the lease itself transferable?
Yes.
And that has to be recorded?
Yes, those transfers have to be recorded.
Further discussion, Representative Brown?
Thank you. Could you explain how this works or how we're meshing the claim system with the leasing system?
Yes.
It's not entirely clear to me how this fits together.
If I could go back a little bit, when the Alaska Supreme Court discussed this, the requirement in the Statehood Act, Section 6I of the Statehood Act, talks about the state must lease its minerals. The Alaska Supreme Court interpreted that to be to produce cash revenues to the state. The emphasis wasn't on issuing a document, a formal lease. The emphasis was on producing cash. So with the advice of the Department of Law, we have constructed a system that maintains existing claim staking system. You still stake that same claim. You still do the annual labor. The addition is that you pay a rent, and if you're in production, you pay a royalty. We will not be issuing hundreds and hundreds of leases. That part of the system maintains the same, it's exactly the same structure as it has been since statehood. We specifically opted to keep it that way to minimize administrative burden. It does not amend. There is a mining leasing section in 3805-205. We use that in environmentally sensitive areas to add special stipulations. About 4% of state land currently falls under this category. This section does not amend that, with the exception of those folks will also be required to pay the same rent and royalty.
Representative Kopanen?
Reading the various Supreme Court decisions on access to common properties, the state court seems to say that we can restrict access so long as the state receives the economic rent.
We were concerned about this common use provision when we were discussing this bill and trying to come up with a reasonable proposal. The 6I opinion applies only to a very specific amount of land, and that's land that was known to be mineral in character at the time of state selection. Depending on who you talk to, that might be 5% of state land, that might be 20% of state land. It's never been determined. However, because of this common use concern, because of public trust concern, the governor introduced a bill that applies to all lands so that all miners on all state lands, including offshore, will pay a cash rent or royalty. We believe that that will suffice some of the common use concerns.
Further discussion?
Where again is it where it says they lose the lease for failure to pay the rental or the royalty?
Yes, that is in Section 7 under the abandonment. It has been amended to add pay any required annual rental, pay any required annual production constitutes abandonments of all rights.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask another question? Sure. Your original proposal had a higher rental schedule
That is correct. The rental schedule had one further. This escalates at $20 a claim to $40 to $100 over a 10-year period. The governor's proposal had a one last escalator to $200 per claim at a 20-year period. As part of the package here, that has been dropped, the last escalator.
And, Mr. Chairman, how long are these valid for? I see in the on page 1, line 10, the lease is valid for up to 55 years and can be renewed. How long can it be renewed for?
Right now, the mining leases under 205 are issued for 20 years, and for however long there is production, that's addressed by regulation. A mining claim is a one-year commitment. Every year you do your annual labor, and in this case now pay your rental or royalty, you continue for another year.
So it's in effect as long as there is production and payment, but other terms are addressed. In other words, normally a lease is a contract, and a breach of any provision of the contract would cancel or give the holder of the contract the right to cancel it. Why are we not setting this up in this manner?
Well, I believe this legislation does set up a system that if you breach the contract, in this case the contract being paying rent and royalty, conducting and filing appropriate annual labor, in this case the contract is, legislatively dictated, you lose it.
But there are other provisions of the lease that could be violated and the state would not have any authority to cancel them.
Well, it's going to be a function of the lease. The lease the leases that are issued will typically require compliance with all permits. That would be a handle to cancel the lease.
Claims, though, we don't have that opportunity,
At this point, we do not.
And how could we modify this legislation so that we would have that opportunity?
In all honesty, I haven't thought about it, and I certainly wouldn't recommend modifying this legislation in front of us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've been interested in this for a long time, and my feeling is that this is we're going to set up a system that's going to be in effect for a long time. This is basically based on a law that was written in 1872, and I think we should think very carefully about what we're putting in place here and be sure that we have adequate safeguards for the state. I don't believe we're going to have this opportunity again. So I have some concerns about this legislation, and I'm going to be preparing some amendments for the committee to consider.
Okay. Representative Kopanen?
Yes, I feel that this is a necessary step in improving the situation, and favor passing it. But this discussion does go return in a strange way to my question with you, because I can see the situation where someone has a fairly lucrative lease, and someone else desiring that will offer a higher percentage, and of course under the law that they have, and then they can sue for that lease, claiming that the economic rent is not being gotten for the state from that property, and they, the aggrieved party, are suing for the opportunity to offer the economic rent, the real economic rent, to the state for the privilege of operating that particular claim. I mean, I can see a dispute between two mining corporations.
Except the Supreme Court specifically addressed the question of whether the return had to be a fair return or whether the state was required to maximize revenue, and it was clear that it had to be a fair return. The issue of maximizing revenue did not apply.
No, I'm not thinking of maximizing the revenue from the viewpoint of the state. I'm thinking of the grounds on which one mining corporation could sue another for access to a piece of mining ground. But that's not before us, but I think there is that possibility.
Well, unfortunately, with the mining business, there's grounds for litigation almost at every turn.
Oh, yeah. A lawyer can always find something.
Any further discussion at this time? Okay, this bill will remain in committee, then it will be brought up by one of our meetings no later than Wednesday. The last bill I wish to take up at this morning session would be Senate Bill number 169. Thank you, Dennis. Senate Bill 169 is an act extending the powers and duties of the Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, Department of Health and Social Services, programs and activities relating to misuse of hazardous, violated substances and inhalant abusers, and providing for an effective date. And it, too, is sponsored by Senator Binkley. And representing Senator Binkley, Janice, right?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Janice Adair. I work for Senator Binkley. Of all the substances abused, we probably know the least about inhalants, yet they're becoming increasingly more of a problem. For example, here in Juneau at Marie Drake, the students are not allowed to have whiteout in their possession because whiteout is so commonly sniffed for a high. We wanted to have somebody in the state gather up what information is available, so it seemed to be the logical choice. This bill does not establish any new programs. It doesn't have a fiscal, it has a zero fiscal note. What we want is for SOTA, as they reach out to gather up information on drug and alcohol abuse, to include what's available on inhalant abuse so that we can get a handle on it. It is a growing problem. This report was put out this last November by the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and it shows that inhalants are growing at the highest rate of all substances that are abused, 9% increase. And that's particularly alarming because most inhalants are highly toxic and they can cause brain damage and sometimes even death. We have had kids die out in rural Alaska by sniffing gasoline fumes. So it is a problem, and we'd like someone to get a handle on it, and that's the purpose of the legislation.
Okay, does anyone have Representative Ulmer?
No questions, just a very brief comment. They're becoming a very popular drug because they're cheap and readily available, and because they do so much serious physical damage to the person that chooses to inhale, they pose perhaps one of the most serious health threats of all of the drugs, and yet they're totally unregulated. And it's extremely difficult to come up with a way to test them as a physical substance in the body, so they're a very serious problem. And if the chairman's ready, I just move the bill from committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have objections? Representative Copeland.
I noticed that it's third nationally, but when we were looking at the marijuana issue, we found it was second in Alaska, and possibly in some areas first, because of its accessibility to very young people. And I noticed there's a few of them that we had selected cases in Orange here, including sniffing propane and things like that. However, there is one. I have one problem with SOTA, and that is that what I'd like to see are some reports written in a manner that would give us some notion of what particular kinds of treatments are useful for what, with which particular kinds of abusers, say, of alcohol, because there are different reasons and different kinds of people of different ages, and we don't really get the kind of information from SOTA that permits us to feel confident that we are always putting the money where it has the greatest effect. So I don't want to add that to the bill, but I do want to send that message along, and that the form in which they give us the data alerts us to the problem, but does not help us figure out whether we're putting our money in the right place. And with that, I remove my objection.
Okay. Are there any objections that are maintained? Hearing none, then Senate Bill 169 has passed from committee with individual recommendation. Okay, on this afternoon's schedule, then, we will have House Bill 85, which is the Program Receipt Bill, House Bill 208, and then any additional action on House Bill 154, if anyone has at this time, although it would not be our intent to do this today, but sometime tomorrow or later. Anything else? Gordon? Okay. Meeting's adjourned. At this time, we've called the Finance Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum, therefore we're able to conduct business. The order that I'd like to take today is first House Bill 208, second House Bill 85. And then third, if there's any discussion in relation to House Bill 154, not with the idea of moving 154 from committee. So House Bill 208 is an act relating to student loans and providing for an effective date. And the prime sponsor, Representative Boyer, is here, so I'd like to recognize Representative Boyer for his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very, very brief on HB 208. I think there are a couple of other people who are here that could answer questions that people may have, but briefly, the bill provides loans through the Student Loan Corporation for half-time students. Currently, only full-time students can access the loan program. This would broaden that out and allow half-time students to get up to half as much money under the undergraduate program, or that's $2,750, or under the graduate program, half the full-time amount, or $3,250. The bill, the CS that you have before you, also goes in and eliminates a redundancy in the statute, and that is the references to the student loan committee. Since the commission is the actual body that makes the loans, the committee is literally a redundancy in the statute. And what started out to be a six-page bill turned into a 12-page bill because we had to restate every section in statute that had a reference to the student loan committee, and that's why the bill is as thick as it is, unfortunately. We set up for the part-time students or half-time students a repayment commencement date of 5 years after you begin to repay your loan. That's in contrast to 10 years for full-time students. There is a deferral, as there is with full-time students, and that deferral, the deferral can be made for all the same reasons that a deferral is made for a full-time student, except for the fact that we're limiting the amount of years that a part-time student or half-time student, excuse me, can defer the loan to 8 years. Our thinking there was that a person could literally come in and continue taking 6 credit hours for virtually ever after having gotten a loan, say the first year of his or her education, and perhaps defer it, well, for certainly a long period of time. And we felt that 8 years was an adequate length of time to provide for a deferral of loan repayment. The perhaps one of the most controversial things in the HES committee when we heard this bill was the fact that we limit the half-time student loans to in-state institutions only. We did get a legal counsel brief that suggested that we wouldn't have any problems with creating the in-state preference here. Wouldn't have any problems with the constitutional issues that had been raised at the HES committee. The legislation actually came to us as a recommendation of the Post-Secondary Education Commission. They had had a meeting in December where they had recommended student loans for part-time students. They, subsequent to that meeting, had another meeting, I think, in February, where they modified that to, instead of part-time students, to half-time students, and that's why I continue to oftentimes refer to it as a part-time student loan bill, but it's now strictly limited to half-time students. That's really all that there is there. All the sections, as I said, of HB 208 amend sections of existing law, the provisions of existing law that currently apply to full-time students but are not referenced in HB 208 would apply to half-time students as well, and things like the 8% interest on loans and the repayment that begins 1 year after the completion of studies are examples of those things, which aren't reflected in the bill, but it would apply to half-time students as well.
Representative Swackhammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd only have one question, Mark. Was there any testimony in HES or any of the other committees that would give us any idea of what it would do on the demands for loans? And the second part of that question is there any kind of criteria that gives preference to full-time students versus half-time students?
There's nothing in the bill that would give preference. In fact, in this bill, as you see it, one is right next to the other, full-time and part-time are referenced in the same sentences. So there is no preference for one over the other. But we did have some information here that indicated that currently the undergraduate students in the UA system total about 1,900 students, on average around 2,000 students per year. And the average age of those students is about 30, almost 31 years old. And we don't expect that there's, and the Post-Secondary Education Commission didn't expect that there was going to be unnecessary competition between types of students in the loan program. Perhaps Mr. Phipps could speak to that more specifically if you'd like to have some additional information.
Sure. Mr. Phipps?
That's correct. We have about 2,000.
Could we ask you to have a seat, please?
For the record, I'm Ron Phipps. I'm the executive director of the commission. That is correct. There are about 2,000 students who are degree-granting students who take between 6 and 11 at the undergraduate level, 6 to 11 credits, or 6 to 8 at the graduate level. The average age is around 30. There are several ways that, or at least two ways, that we could limit that demand if indeed that became a problem. First of all, I don't think it will be a problem. I think that not all of those folks would apply for the loan. But if they did, either through regulation or through statute, there could be a percentage, for instance, for part-time folks. So right now, for instance, we have a percentage for vocational students at 20%. So we could, that one way we could do it, or we could say a flat number. There are several ways that we could limit it if there, indeed there was a conflict between full-time and part-time students.
Right. I guess, Mr. Chairman, I like the concept of the bill and also like the idea of the five-year repayment, but would like to see priority given to full-time students, in terms of a student loan.
Chairman Huffman?
Well, looking at your figures here, those students that you have a large number of students that are taking 6 hours or six credits, 700, just about 800, and it stays pretty constant until you get to the 11th credit, and that drops down to under 100. And it seems as though it's low because a lot of people take that 12th credit in order to get the loans. And how many additional students will be reducing their credit hours in order because they don't have to comply with the number of credits that they're taking? Has there been any determination of that? Is that group substantial?
I'm sorry, I was getting my papers. Were you asking Representative Hoffman whether or not some folks would change from full-time to part-time?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that would be the case. I think there is a class of student who would really like to go part-time. I'm thinking of a displaced homemaker. I'm thinking of folks who have a job and are trying to upgrade their skills. In fact, I think this bill addresses those kind of people. And I think that what would happen there are a group of folks who would welcome this because then they could take a lesser load, they could maintain their job, and they could move ahead towards a degree.
And the other question, if I might continue, a substantial number of those students are in the six-hour level of approximately 800, and then seven credits is 250, eight credits is 123, so why are we allowing, what was the magical figure of, besides capturing a large number of students at 6 hours, that the 6 hour be the cutoff?
Mr. Phipps?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hoffman. The bill's a half time is by definition 6 hours, so it's somewhat arbitrary in that respect. There was some talk of either lowering that to 3 or 2, 4 or 5 hours, even lower, or even raising it. The issue here, I think, is to identify the serious student, that student who really needs to move ahead and upgrade his or her skills. I think, at least for some folks, the thinking was if it were 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 credits, that student is perhaps not as serious as the student who is trying to get ahead, trying to finish the degree. And so 6 was a reasonable number, a reasonable compromise between full-time and some credit, some portion of a program which is half-time.
Just a couple of general questions. And if a student has taken 9 hours, then they'd be eligible for still one half of whatever the student loan would be. Is that correct?
That would be the maximum. It would. It, it, uh, uh, the the um, The maximum is $2,750 for undergraduate and $3,250 for graduate. So it would only cover tuition, fees, books. And I believe the committee substitute had room and board.
And how about under the full-time where they have to come up with the first $500 and the half-time, do they have to come up with the first $250 here?
That would be up to this group, indeed. We did not contemplate that because of the small amount of the loan. That certainly can be provided
still,
for.
Still come up with the first $500, then? Would they have to meet that standard?
They would not, as the bill is addressed.
And you feel comfortable that the impact on the program itself of allowing an additional group of half-time students is not going to have a negative impact on the ability to provide loans to the full-time students?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I think certainly for the near future, I don't think it will have a negative impact. Perhaps down the line, there may be a negative impact, and at that time, I think perhaps some limit could be placed upon part-time students, perhaps, again, 5% or 10%, or some limit, so the impact would be minimal.
Let me ask the sponsor, because one of the things that we made a big judgment on in relation to the $6,000 being reduced to $5,500 was for the student himself to have to come forward with at least some amount of money. I feel that this bill would be a better bill if even the half-time students had to come forward with at least $250. And I just ask your response in relation to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my guess, or how I'd like to respond, is to suggest that at $2,750 for a loan for 4 months' worth of school, the student's going to have to come up with substantial resources to meet his or her educational needs anyway, and just to pay room and board and beyond this $2,700 is going to take substantial resources, and it's quite different from $5,500 or $6,500.
Well, the large number of part-time students, though, won't be students going away to school, or won't be students staying in residential halls or even in cafeterias. They'll be students living at home, traveling to one of the branch colleges. So I don't know whether the $2,700 wouldn't totally cover the cost or not.
Mr. Chairman, actually the background of this bill goes back at least 6 years. We were looking at the way in which the student loan program was being used, not only by students, but by the educational institutions, and we found that the full-time students, by and large, let's put it this way, the schools within Alaska that had students attending and using the student loan program were the university branches and APU, but not the community colleges, by and large. And because of the requirement of a full-time program, the way it was defined within the university system, whereas proprietary schools could spring up and would define their programs, whether they were short or long, in terms of full-time attendance. So actually what was happening is that we were forcing the organization of proprietary schools, not all of which had the resources or the administrative capability to continue to operate, like the ones that folded and left the students holding their loans. We know that the university system programs, including the vocational and technical courses, will continue into the future. And we want to make the loan program available to those students. The only way we can do this is either by having them redefine what a full-time program is, however we've defined it in statute, by a certain number of credit hours. The university system has a credit hour system. So if we wish to make the programs that we are paying for available to people who are working for a living or who cannot, for various reasons, raising a family or the like, attend full-time in 12 or more credit hours, and especially attend the kind of vocational technical programs where you don't take necessarily a 12-hour course. We originally proposed it to be vocational, part-time vocational technical students or community college students, but those attempts fell by the board, and precisely the reasons that you mentioned. So I think, you know, there's more to it than that, as the prime sponsor pointed out. The majority of students undertaking these kinds of courses are in their late 20s and up to mid 30s. So they are already self-supporting. They're not living at home except with themselves and their spouses. And we're trying to extend, make the program more useful. I think, also restricted to the programs within the state. I think it becomes harder to monitor, too, if we allow people to go part-time in Washington, Oregon, or Tierra del Fuego.
Yeah, I have no problems with the part-time. My only concern is that we put in the $500 for the full-time student to make the student more responsible in determining, I guess, whether or not they were really serious about going to school. And if they were willing to put up $500 of their own money, we were willing to provide a $5,500 loan. I think before that, we found that there were a lot of people getting the student loan simply because they didn't have to put up any of their own money. They went to school for a period of time. They dropped out, said we didn't get anything out of it, and therefore we're not paying anything back. And that's a large part of our delinquent record right now. And I feel that maybe that personal obligation is even more important in relation to a person who determines to go back to school on a part-time basis. That maybe there should be something. If they're serious, is asking them to put up $250 towards their own education too much? Because unless I'm incorrect, I think at the, I still want to call them community colleges, but at the colleges today, an undergraduate credit hour is what, about $90?
I believe it's 40.
How much, 30? Okay, that's $120 we're asking them to pay for their education. Now, if they're traveling back and forth at home, that still gives them $2,200 for the traveling expenses or meals at home or something else. And most of these part-time students are going to be living at home. I just do not feel, you know, I'd like to support this bill, and I think with a $250 contribution out of the student themselves that I could, but without that, I feel we're backing away from our philosophy that we have provided as a standard for the full-time student, and I would feel very uncomfortable. So further discussion. Representative Rieger?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On that point, in the sectional that's back here, there's a Section 3 that limits the use of the halftime loans to books, tuitions, and fees. And CS, I can't find it. Was that deleted?
It was deleted by the test committee.
Okay. If I can do the chair, ask Representative Boyer why.
Well, the thinking was that effectively when you make the loan, it's one pocket or the other. And it's kind of artificial. We were artificially restricting what one person could use, to pay their room and board effectively, with the recognition that it really is just taking one, a dollar from one pocket or the other. That it's fairly artificial, and the committee felt fairly strongly that we shouldn't discriminate that way.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. In the new language of how you can become eligible for a deferral of interest. There is, it's on page 5 in the center. It says, return to half-time student status. Can a full-time student, quote-unquote, return to half-time status? Or is it only half-time students that can return to half-time status?
Full-time students can return to half-time status, I think is the answer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, indeed, a full-time student could go half-time or full-time.
What if a full-time student only passed half their classes? Could they then look upon that as a part-time student and be eligible for a loan the next semester on a part-time basis?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. What would happen if they only passed half of their classes? They then would not be in good standing, and they would not be eligible for either.
Look, I guess it does seem like, I don't know, maybe it's not something to be concerned about, but it does seem like you can defer your interest for 8 years as long as you kind of keep taking a few courses each year.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That is correct. Under the bill as written, if a person is a half-time student, they can defer principal and interest for the total of 8 years, no longer than 8 years.
Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Chairman, I mean, after you've graduated, maybe you can go back and take some half-time classes.
In this bill, that's correct. If a student went full-time for, say, 4 years, got a baccalaureate degree, then went to school half-time, I think as written, he could have his full-time loan deferred. A recommendation would be that be modified so that a full-time student could not use a half-time loan to defer his full-time payment.
Now, hold it. Now I'm really confused.
Yeah, okay.
I assume that 6 months after graduation, whether a student is going full-time or half-time, that they would then have to start repaying their loan. But you're telling me no, that they would not have to repay it now until after 8 years if they took part of their undergraduate work as a part-time student?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is written, if a full-time student, let's use that same example, goes to school 4 years, graduates. I think as written, he then or she could then go to school half-time and have that principal and interest deferred. I would recommend that it be modified that would not happen. A student who went full-time and who borrowed the money would indeed have to pay back the full-time loan, even though they went to school half-time.
And Mr. Chairman, that issue has been explored in the other body. We have an identical bill in the Senate and in the HES committee. It was an issue we hadn't thought about, but has been explored there. And I think that you do have some language prepared that might take care of it if it were the interest of the committee to take care of that problem.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Barnes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think I have three issues. One, the issue that's presently at hand. It seems to me that if you had a student that had just finished college and was trying to go on to college half-time and they were only working half-time, that they might have a lot of trouble trying to pay back their loan that they had and the interest on that loan while they were continuing to go to school because they were only able to work part-time to go to school part-time. So it seems to me that might work an extreme hardship. So I think we need to give some more consideration to that. Secondly, I believe I brought an issue to your attention. I'm not aware of how it was resolved. And I would like to know if maybe this is a piece of legislation, if legislation is required, that issue can be fixed in. The issue, Mr. Chairman, is, and it may relate to other types of schools, I don't know, but to one in particular. There is a beauty school in Anchorage that the present owner, has owned it now for a short period of time, but has been in business in the Anchorage area for at least 15 years and has had students in his shop during that time. He bought this school with the understanding that the students would be able to continue to get a student loan to go to beauty college, career vocational education type program. And I believe that, unless I am mistaken, unless you have fixed it, he is not able, or the students that are going to school there is not able to get that loan because he's not owned that school for 2 years, although the school has been there forever. And he's been in business in Anchorage for 15 years. So if you could address that, I would like. The second part, maybe he can address that at the same time, is the whammy language that we put in the budget bill. I wonder if codifying it in statutes as it relates to the people that participate in whammy coming back and working in the rural areas of the state, if that would be conducive to codified in statutes in this bill.
In that context, I'll allow the question in codifying within this bill.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to address all three issues?
If you would, please.
I'd be delighted to. Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnes, I think the first issue related to the student who would graduate, for instance, from a four-year institution and then start going to school half-time, and you're right. I think it would be, indeed, if a student went to school 4 years, he could indeed have a bill for around $20,000. And then if he were going to school half-time, I presume it would be difficult for that student to pay back his loan. I think the thrust of the bill before us addresses a class of students that haven't received their baccalaureate yet, who are, this really gets at the issue of lifelong learning, folks who are either trying to upgrade skills that don't have a degree, or people who have been in the field for a while because they're about 30 years old, and therefore they could still use a loan, but indeed they are not so destitute that it would be difficult for them to pay back. So I think the class of student that this tries to address perhaps doesn't that scenario that you paint may not happen often. Second issue, in terms of the beauty school not being able to accept student loans, what happened in that case is that this was a new school. Even though the owner is in the same site, it is a brand new school, and the statute does say that any brand new school must be in existence for 2 full years before they can accept student loans. So that would have to be changed in statute, and if indeed this was the appropriate statute for that, then so be it. The third issue, I assume you're suggesting if a student comes back to the
state. The WAMI program that we put into the language that we put into the budget bill.
About returning to the state?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's an issue I think that has, in terms of the student loan program, has been brought up time and time again. Of course, the notion of forgiveness tried to get at that issue, bring folks back to the state. There really wouldn't be any change because whether a student is in the state or goes out of the state, they still have to pay back the loan. So this is a loan rather than a WAMI grant.
Mr. Chairman, I think he missed the point with the WAMI program. We put intent language in the budget that said if you participated in the WAMI program that to, and I don't remember the exact language, that to get forgiveness of that you had to come back into the state and work in one of the rural areas X number of years. And I just wondered if this would be a good bill to codify that language and statutes in. Because what we did, we said you would adopt that by regulation. I think you were here that day.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnes, that would certainly be us to this body. I have no opinion on that. Indeed,
thank you.
You all felt it would be appropriate.
Any further discussion? Representative Ulmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if someone could share with us the language that was being considered in the Senate that Representative Boyer made reference to previously that we might want to include in a House Finance Subcommittee.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this had been prepared to a different version, obviously, but in this bill, it would be in the HESCS, it would be page 5, lines 10 and 14, where you would, in that section 1 and 2, that now would allow you to defer your loan, would only allow you to defer your loan in the first case, if you were continuing to be a full-time student, and in the second case, a part-time student, and then again, or half-time student, and then again, only for 8 years as a half-year student, so it would not allow, if we adopted this language, would not allow for a full-time student who graduated to go back to school as a half-time student and defer his full-time student loan.
Move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have a motion to adopt the amendment. Do we have any discussion? Are there any objections?
Hearing none, then the amendment has been adopted. I don't have the language for that $250 to be put in.
Mr. Phipps, we can ask Mr. Phipps, do you know the site off the top of your head?
I think it's in regulation, and if you'd like, you can certainly just place that in the bill that way. That
by lines 10 and 14.
What lines would that be?
On page 5, line 10, where it says return to full time.
Different sheet.
Mr. Chair?
The part that I'm interested in is right now we require, and is that under regulation?
I believe it is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I see everyone nodding yes.
To do that also under regulation, I believe. If, we don't really need...
If, with the consent of the sponsor, I'd like to put it in the record here that I feel strongly that there should be some effort on the part of the student in the range of $250 in order to become eligible for the cost. I see the sponsor nodding yes. Do we have further discussion on that subject? Representative Ullman.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to recommend that we might do a letter of intent to accompany the bill to have it be something beyond just finance committee minutes.
Real good. Any other discussion then? If we can do it that way, I will have a letter of intent drafted that basically says that it is intent of the legislature that the responsibility on the part of the student will be $250 and therefore then be eligible for the remainder. Chairman Hoffman.
Then under this program, only Alaskans that are two-year residents will be able to qualify for this program.
Just as is the current practice for full-time students.
Chairman, Representative Copeland and Barnes?
On your point there, the original draft of the bill had a section that proceeds from the scholarship loan may only be used for books, for full-time students, book tuition required fees and for room and board. The $500 addition, when we made that change, the discussion was around that the typical cost of on-campus room and board was, depending on the campus, between $500 and $600 at that time, so the student had to make their own room and board. So our solution to that in the original...